Hi, my name is Scott, and I'm a member with Restored Church. If you're new, we want to welcome you and thank you for tuning in. We believe the church is not an event, but a family you belong to, so we would love the opportunity to connect with you. If you want to learn more about our church, or if we can help you in any way, please visit our website, www.restoredtemecula.church, and click on Contact. We also have a mobile app with resources, including our Sunday messages, information about upcoming events, and other ways to connect. You can download our app on the Apple or Android app stores. With all that said, we hope you enjoyed the message. I love you guys.
All right, guys, good to be with you. So my name is Herrick. If I haven't had the chance to meet you yet, I would love to. I'm one of the elders here of Restored Temecula, and I want to welcome you. And this morning, we're going to be spending some time in the Old Testament. And we're going to, a few of you are excited about this. It's great. There's a lot of real gold to be mined in the story that we're going to unpack today. Unfortunately, I only get one sermon. This could easily be a series. This person is so rich and complex that we're going to focus really on one person, that we could talk about this story for weeks, but we're just going to spend and focus on one part of this story today. So for the Bible nerds in the room, you're going to be like, man, there's so much more to the story. I couldn't agree with you more. But we only have so much time, so we're going to really focus and key in on a few things. So if you'll join me, I want to pray before I get started. Pray for me. Help me, Lord, as we dive into this text this morning. I pray that you would open up our eyes and our ears to hear you, to see you, to see ourselves even in a fresh way, not for the purpose of condemnation or judgment, but actually for the purpose of freedom, for the purpose of being made new, for the purpose of experiencing your grace. Like we won't ask for grace unless we realize we need it. And so I pray that today you would help us to become a little bit more aware of our need and your willingness to provide for what we need. Father, thank you. I pray that you would help me this morning just to speak your word, and then you do the rest. God, we love you. In your name, amen. So this week I was reminiscing. I'm about to turn 40. In a month, and thank you. I've almost made it. We'll see what these next few weeks hold, but I'm not prophesying my impending death, just to be clear. I plan to live, but I was reminiscing. 1993 was a big year in my life. I moved from Puerto Rico out here to the States, and when I was a kid. We had the privilege of traveling, and we would go to New York City. That was my favorite place. It still is my favorite place. Let's go Mets. I think I just throw that out there for free. Mets in six. Come back to me in a week and a half. We'll see if that holds true. but I used to love New York City. And part of it was just because I had seen it in movies so many times. I'd seen all these parts of New York City, and I was just like, wow, this is where they shot Home Alone 2, and you know, like all this stuff. And so when I moved out here, it was a little bit different. When I moved out here, the place that really gripped my imagination was a little place called Universal Studios in Hollywood. And I was like, this is incredible. I know this set. I know it was shot here. You know, like all these things popped up. And so I would love going to Universal Studios in Hollywood. Has anybody been there before? I don't know how popular it is these days. Okay, yeah, about 2/3. You guys know. My absolute favorite place, can anybody guess what my favorite part of Universal Studios was? All right. So I've been discipling you well into my preferences. So my favorite place was this little ride called Back to the Future. And, has anybody ridden that ride before? Okay, not that many. Okay, a few, okay, cool. So it was this amazing place. It was called the Institute of Future Technology. Can't get into all the details. You can watch it on YouTube later if you'd like. But I used to love going to this ride. I had a whole like ritual to it. We'd go to the ride. We would eat Doc's fancy fried chicken. Anybody eat that? Nope. About one person, Dorian and I. Yep. And then you would make a beeline for the toilet right after. But it was the happiest. The whole thing was just such a happy moment. And my favorite part was picture number one in the back. If you guys wouldn't mind putting that on the screen. This. That is the Back to the Future A car, the hero car, the one that they shot. They made about seven of these kind of DeLoreans that they use for the filming of the movies. This is the A car. This is the one that they use in most of the shots. That was sitting out there in front of the Back to the Future ride. Does anybody ever take a picture in front of that? Kylo did. Jonathan, great. All right. So I looked really hard to see if I can find a picture of me in front of it, and instead I found picture number two. That's not it. That's what it would have looked like if I had actually found it. That's it. I found a picture of me in front of Doc and Marty at the Wax Museum, which, by the way, Wax Museums, I thought were completely, like, there's no way these things still exist. So popular still. One of the biggest tourist attractions, I guess, in Hollywood. Yeah, my eyes are, I look crazy in that picture, but that's me. And I am wearing an angel's hat, and the more things change, the more they do not change. And then picture number three is what it would have looked like if you could have found me in front of that. So big part of my childhood, I really, really loved it. And so it was a part of, I stopped going to Universal Studios probably, I don't know, when I was in middle school. And so I hadn't been there for a really, really long time. They got rid of that ride. It became a Simpsons ride, which, whatever. Which is terrible, according to Dorian. I can't confirm or deny whether that's true or not, though I believe Dorian. It's not going to be as good as this. Now, here's what I learned over the course of time. That hero car, the Back to the Future A car, was actually, it was used a lot. If you went to Universal Studios around that time, you would see it. Sometimes they'd drive it around the park. They had a Doc Brown that would, you know, drive around and pop out and jump out at you. And but by and large, at a certain point, it just got left in the back lot of the Universal Studios kind of tour. And so it was left to the elements. It was left out in the rain. It was left out in the sun. And here's what happened to it. Can we get video clip number one? I'm putting Trenton to work today. Dude, do we have sound?
First,
there we go.
You turn the time circuits on. If you're gonna build a time machine into a car, why not do it with some style?
Are you telling me that this sucker is nuclear?
This is what makes time travel possible.
That's capacitor.
We're sending you back to the future.
Time was not good to the time machine.
It had been sitting out in the rain for years, and all these pieces started to fall off the car.
Every animal possible made a home inside the car.
Anybody could just walk right up to it. Anybody could go in there and sit in it.
Fans would go out there to get a collectible, a memento.
The flux capacitor and the time circuits were missing. The most essential parts of the time machine were just gone.
I had a dream once that I was driving around in the DeLorean. I didn't realize it could have been a reality if I had just snuck onto the back to the Universal Studios back lot. The car was neglected to the point where they just started leaving the keys in it. And so there's video of people like going in, turning the car on and being like, wow, look at the flux capacitor. It's fluxy. Like you could literally, there's videos of this. This car, which was worth about $3 to $4 million, roughly, was left unguarded with the keys inside. I mean, it really is. It's a wonder that the car was even there, that it wasn't just completely stolen and disappeared off the face of the earth. But here's the key thing that I realized after learning about this. The car that so captured my imagination and so many people's imaginations, that car was no longer what it was intended to be. It ceased to be that. And it was actually very close to just breaking down completely and becoming scrap. Being scrapped. And so here's the thing, as I was thinking about it, that really is an icon of Hollywood, right? That DeLorean. Everybody knows, even if you've never seen the movie, you know that car. That car is one of the most recognizable icons in film history. Now, an icon is a really interesting word. It actually comes from the Greek icon. Did anybody know that? Do you know what icon, how that's used in the Bible? It's used as the icon of God, the image of God. People are created as the image of God. Human beings represent God in the same way that the Back to the Future DeLorean represents the movie and the trilogy and the story. An icon of Hollywood is falling into disrepair. And so today what we're going to do is we're going to read a story that talks about a biblical icon, as it were, an image of God that fell into disrepair. Someone who stopped being what they were meant to be. And so we're going to read a story today, and it has so much to offer us because it reveals that we too can fall into disrepair as human beings. People who were meant to display the beauty and the glory of God can fall into disrepair to the point where they are almost, they're on the scrap heap, as it were. It's tragedy, but it happens. It can happen. And so we're going to read a story. The scriptures are written for our instruction and for our encouragement. They're written so that we can learn from them. And so today we're going to do that because I think there's much for us to learn and benefit from in this story. So I want to invite you to join me. Go over to 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. If you don't have a Bible with you, that's okay. We're going to have the verses up on the screen, verses 9 to 31. And today we're going to talk about a man whose name was Saul. If you're not familiar with the story, I'm referring to Saul who became king. Not Saul who we now commonly call the Apostle Paul. So not that Saul, a different Saul. A Saul in the Old Testament. And now the story itself is remarkable. In fact, if you read 1 Samuel, it's just like chapter after chapter after chapter after chapter, unpacking the story of Saul, and we just don't have time to do that. But what I will say is I'll give a little bit of historical context about what's going on. It was not a great time in Israel's history, the people of God. In fact, there was a moment that kind of led up to Saul becoming the king of Israel, which we're gonna see a story, a little vignette out of his life. But he became king because the people of God actually wanted a king. They asked for one. Essentially, they were going through problems. They were under pressure, and they wanted a king like the nations around them. The nations around them had a king. What was different, though, about the people of Israel? God was their king. God was their king. And so they were essentially asking, even though God was their king, give us a king that will fight our battles for us. We want security. We want safety. We want a human king that will secure all that for us. And so it's the story itself, it has the wildest beginning. It starts with God saying to the prophet Samuel, who we're going to meet here in a minute, the prophet Samuel was a true prophet of God. He spoke God's words accurately. He was a mouthpiece for God. And so the prophet Samuel was really upset at the people because they requested a king, even though they had a king. God tells him, hey, they haven't rejected you. They rejected me as their king. And so sometimes, this is the crazy, there's so much we could talk about here. But you have to understand that sometimes the judgment of God comes when God just gives us what we want. Because the people wanted a king. They had one. They rejected that king. But they wanted a king, somebody who would fight their battles. And God said, okay, you can have it. And so naturally, the prophet Samuel was grieved because he knew this is going to end poorly. And he was exactly right. Why? Was it because Saul was... let's just get into it. All right, 1 Samuel 15, chapter... 1 Samuel, good luck finding that one. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 9 to 31. The context here is that God had given Saul a very clear command to wipe out this group of people. Now, that I don't have time to get into all of that, but you have to understand this was divine judgment coming on a group of people. It wasn't random. It wasn't something that was God just woke up on the wrong side of bed. There was some deep, deep wrongs that this people had committed, and so it was their time. It was their time. And so God raised up Saul and sent Saul to destroy and to basically wipe this people group out. And this is what happened. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 9 says, Saul and the troops, they spared Agag, their king of the people, and the best of the sheep, goats, cattle, and choice animals. as well as the young rams and the best of everything else. And so they were supposed to destroy all that, but they were not willing. But they did destroy all the worthless and the unwanted things. Okay, so this had been a command that had come from God through the prophet Samuel to the king, and the king did not obey that commandment. King Saul. So then the word of the Lord came to Samuel the prophet. Verse 11, it says, "I regret that I made Saul king, for he has turned away from following me and has not carried out my instructions." Here's the crazy part. Even though the people very clearly had rejected God in asking for this king, God was still willing. He was still like, hey, if you'll listen to my voice, even under this king, I'm going to bless you, and I'm going to carry through my promises here. But the people weren't willing to listen to God, and then Saul wasn't willing to listen to God either. And so Samuel, verse 11, the second half, says, Samuel became angry and cried out to the Lord all night. Verse 12, early in the morning, Samuel got up to confront Saul. But it was reported to Samuel that Saul went to Carmel and he set up a monument for himself. So it just keeps getting worse. He immortalized his disobedience through a monument. Then he turned around and went down to Gilgal. Verse 13, when Samuel came to him, Saul said, "May the Lord bless you. I have carried out the Lord's instructions now." Did he actually carry out the Lord's instructions? Not really. Partially. And I love that he just starts out, "May the Lord bless you." It's like, "How are you today?" "Blessed." Kind of vibe, you know? And "I've carried out the Lord's instructions." And then Samuel says, "What's that? What's that I hear? The ba, the sheep in the background, the goats, the cattle, right? These animals that were supposed to be devoted for destruction." So Samuel's having, I don't know if he's having fun, but I'm having fun just picturing this situation because it's so absurd. There's the sheep, the goats, and the cattle. It's supposed to be silent, but they're there. There's a soundtrack. 15, Saul answered, "The troops, they brought them from the Amalekites and spared the best sheep, goats, and cattle in order to offer a sacrifice to the Lord your God, but the rest we destroyed." So what's happening there? A little blame shifting. Who does that sound like to you? The man or the woman you gave me. She did it. It was the serpent. You know, like it's just a repetition of the fall. This is part of Saul's fall. Verse 16, it says, stop. Samuel has had it. He's like, "Shut your face, Saul. Listen to me. You shut up when I'm talking to you, Saul. Let me tell you what the Lord has said to me at last." And finally, the smartest thing Saul has said the whole time is like, "Okay, tell me." Verse 17, Samuel continued, "Although you once considered yourself unimportant," well, that's a reference to how this whole thing started. When this started, Saul had, there was a sense of humility to him that has now gone missing. Sometimes it's possible to start well and end poorly, even when God's hand's on your life. "Although you considered yourself unimportant, haven't you become the leader of the tribes of Israel? The Lord anointed you king over Israel and then sent you on a mission and said, go and completely destroy the sinful Amalekites. Fight against them until you have annihilated them." Verse 19, "So why didn't you obey the Lord? Why did you rush on the plunder and do what was evil in the Lord's sight?" Verse 20, "But I did obey the Lord," Saul answered. "I went on the mission the Lord gave me. I brought back King Agag of Amalek, and I completely destroyed the Amalekites. The troops took sheep, goats, and cattle from the plunder, the best of what was set apart for destruction to sacrifice the Lord your God at Gilgal." Then Samuel said, "Does the Lord take pleasure in burnt offerings and sacrifices as much as in obeying the Lord? Look, to obey is better than sacrifice. To pay attention is better than the fat of rams." Verse 23, "For rebellion is like the sin of divination, and defiance is like wickedness and idolatry, because you have rejected the word of the Lord. He has rejected you as king." This is a tragic turn of events for Saul and for the people and for Samuel. Samuel was grieved. Samuel, as it were, loved Saul. Samuel loved the Lord. Like, this was a grievous thing. If you ever read just some of these stories in the Bible, whether you're in the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, or you're in the New Testament, it's actually full of really sad, tragic tales. Not because I think the writers of Scripture had a morbid fascination with failure, but because I think they're honest about the human condition and the way that our lives tend to go. And so, verse 24, Saul answered Samuel, "I have sinned. I've transgressed the Lord's commands and your words. Because I was afraid of the people, I obeyed them. Now, therefore, please forgive my sin and return with me so I can worship the Lord." Verse 26, Samuel replied to Saul, "I will not return with you. Because you rejected the word of the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel." Now Samuel turned to go, and then Saul grabbed the corner of his robe and tore it. Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingship of Israel away from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you." Dude, this, you can't make this stuff up. You cannot make this up. Saul grabs his robe, rips it without meaning to, and Samuel's just like that, "You've been torn away. The kingdom's been torn from you." Just baller move, just as a side note. Whatever you may think of the story, whatever you think of the Bible, it's not dull, and it doesn't lack cleverness. That's a genius move by Samuel. And it just keeps getting worse for Saul. Verse 29, "Furthermore, the Eternal One of Israel does not lie or change his mind, for he's not a man who changes his mind." Verse 30, Saul said, again, this is the second time he's going to say this, "I have sinned. Please honor me now before the elders of my people and before Israel. Come back with me so I can bow and worship to the Lord your God." Then Samuel went back following Saul, and Saul bowed down to the Lord. And that's where we're gonna end it for today. So if you're taking notes, here's two questions we're going to answer with the time that I have. Number one, what caused Saul to falter? Number two, what can we learn? What caused Saul to falter? What can we learn? Number one, what caused Saul to falter? 1 Samuel 15:24 says, "Saul answered Samuel, 'I have sinned. I have transgressed the Lord's command and your words. Because I was afraid of the people, I obeyed them.'" I was at, recently, not too long ago, I was at an autograph signing. They do these at Pechanga every so often. And so they'll bring an Angels player by, and he'll sign autographs or whatever. And so I took my son, and we went to an autograph signing, and so we're sitting there. And it was an interesting room. So I don't know if you know this. This isn't the point of today's talk, but the Angels aren't that good. Longtime fan saying this. And so what's interesting is that they had this guy, his name's Shohei Ohtani, and he's not with us anymore. He moved up to Hollywood, as it were, and is now creating magic, movie magic, on a nightly basis with LA. Now, here's the interesting part. When you go to one of these autograph signings, there's a lot of downtime, and so you just kind of wait, because there's hundreds of people there, and they have to sign, and then, like, one person takes a picture, and now everyone wants to take a picture, so it's just like, oh my gosh, this is taking forever. So we're just sitting there waiting for an autograph from this Angels player, and they're kind of like filling in the time. They have to find something to do. And so they start asking people questions, you know, and then they'll give away tickets to a game no one wants to go to because it's the Angels and they're terrible. But that room is very pro-Angels, right? And I'm not sure where I'm at, but the whole room is like very pro. The Angels are great. If we're going to turn the corner next year, you know, kind of vibe. Next year has been, doesn't matter. So I'm sitting there, and the guy who's hosting this thing, the MC, is going around asking questions. And it's sort of like, if you've ever been in one of those environments, you're like, oh my gosh, what are they going to say? Like, there's some awkward things thrown around in that environment. And so he I think he kind of plays it safe and asks, like, who's your favorite Angels player? Here's the problem. I think 90% of that room a year ago would have answered that, Shohei Ohtani, right? But now he's not there anymore. He's like an ex-girlfriend. You can't admit or acknowledge I'm still into her. She broke up with me. She left me for another guy. The Hollywood type. And so, but here's the thing, dude. Shohei Ohtani's still the best. And somebody, they go around asking who's their favorite player, and they're kind of like, Zach Neto. He's the guy signing the autographs. Great guy, too. Very sweet. Zach Neto, yeah. Logan Ohapi, yeah. Zach Neto, yeah. There's nobody else on the team that's even good. And then one kid bravely says, Shohei Ohtani. Boo. You know, kind of boo vibes. And then they're still going around, and they're getting closer to Josh, and I'm like, Josh is going to answer this Ohtani 100%. And I'm in that room, and I'm just, I don't know if you've ever been in that spot where you just feel that feeling of like, oh my gosh, everyone's going to look at us and boo, you know, like, and point and laugh or whatever. And I'm just sitting there thinking like, please, God, don't put the mic in Josh's hand. Like, he's not aware of room dynamics. So if he says the truth, the people are going to turn on him, and it's going to, you know, like, it's going to embarrass me, it's going to embarrass him. It's like, you can't say Shohei Ohtani. Shame and derision will fall. I was terrified of the crowd, is what I realized. I think it was a moment. So I had a laugh about it later. Thankfully, they just kept going, and Josh didn't get his mic time that night. But it got me thinking about the fact that, like, oh my gosh, I am so scared of a room like that, of being honest in a room like that. Why? Because the crowd is going to turn on me. Who's my favorite Angels player? Shohei Ohtani. It's a confusing answer. I guess if I continue the dating analogy, I guess I'm single, but my ex is my thing. I'm going to end that now. I'm very happily married. She's sick at home with kids. But I think you guys know what I'm saying. It's a really silly example, I know. But it really got me thinking, like, how often do I suppress the truth because of what it might cost me? How often do I suppress the truth because of what it might cost me in the environment that I'm in the room that I'm in, or the people that I'm face to face with? Man, what caused Saul to falter? If you're taking notes, write this down. He listened to the crowd, not the crown. Saul listened to the crowd, not the crown. What do I mean by the crown? I mentioned earlier that the people of Israel rejected God as their king. It's a reference to the king, the capital K. Saul listened to the crowd, not the crown. Super important. So I just want to ask a question this morning as we're thinking about Saul's story. Again, there's so much more we can say about Saul, but just for the sake of time, I want to narrow in. When it comes down to it, like, what matters most to you? Think about your own life. Think about when the eyes are on you. Think about when you might be in a spot where speaking the truth about God or owning the truth about who you are in Him or just obeying Him in a hard way. Think about a situation like that. What matters most to you in those moments? Is it to save face or is it to stay free? Is it PR and spin or honoring your King, even if it makes you look bad? Or foolish, or silly. Man, Saul listened to the crowd, not the crown, and it led to his crash. What can we learn from this? Number two. I'm going to try to keep it brief this morning. 1 Samuel chapter 15, verses 19 to 23. This is the prophet Samuel talking to Saul. And he asked them just a very honest question. Hey, why? That question, by the way, it can be used in ways that could really injure people, right? Like you can ask why questions in a very kind of unloving way. But sometimes the most important question that we can ask is just why? See, 1 Samuel chapter 15, verse 19 says, this is Samuel asking Saul, why? Why didn't you obey the Lord? Why did you rush? Why did you rush on the plunder and do what was evil in the Lord's sight? I want to just put this in front of us. I don't have the book in front of me, but I was going to bring up the blue book. How many of you guys have been through the gospel-centered community before in this room? A lot of the room. If you're new, it's the gospel-centered community. This blue book is what we'd use in the intro to gospel community phase of our community, which essentially is like your first step if you want to become a part of a gospel community, which our church is made up of gospel communities. It's the primary organizing structure of our church. We're not a church that has gospel communities. We're a church of gospel communities. And so the first step to becoming a part of our church community, really in gospel community, is to go through that blue book. And we actually spend a whole season going through it. We're doing it right now with the intro. My intro peeps, where are you at? Yeah. Right up the gut, up the spine, I should say, of our church. But this is really the key to the whole thing. If you like, I'm a very simple-minded thinker, and I can really only like think about one thing at a time, although I try to do multiple things at a time, and I really can't. But the whole intro to gospel community focuses really on one question, which is learning how to ask why we do what we do so that we can understand our own hearts and understand the ways in which our hearts take us away from believing God and trusting him. So that we can get good at repentance, so that we can get good at saying, I don't actually believe. We had a conversation this week in the intro where I was reminded of a book that I read a long time ago. It's a great book. It's called Gospel Fluency by Jeff Vanderstelt. If you've never read it, it's a great, great read. And he starts the book off by saying, we're all unbelievers. It's a pretty strong statement because it's a book written by Christians for Christians. But the truth is, like, we all struggle to believe. And so when somebody gets into a spot where they need some help, it's okay to ask why. You want to do it with humility. You want to do it with love. But we want to get to the point where we can say, what's underneath that? Saul disobeyed the Lord, and it was clear as day. How do we know? Because the Lord was speaking to him through Samuel, the prophet. And the Samuel, the prophet, was well attested to. He was a genuine prophet of God. And so why? Why? Verse 20, 1 Samuel 15, verse 20 says, I did obey the Lord. Saul answered, I went on the mission the Lord gave me. I brought back King Agag of Amalek, and I completely destroyed the Amalekites. And it goes on from there. I remember once being in my office in the law firm that I worked at in San Diego. I wasn't a lawyer, but I helped the attorneys that I worked with some of their research. And we sat in a big table, and we each had like a corner of the table was kind of ours, and so it was kind of, I think there was like usually four of us on one side of the table, another four of us on the other side of the table, so we're all working in like pretty close proximity to each other. And I remember once I was in a season of life where I was working there, and I kind of had my headphones in constantly, and I wear headphones, I listen to stuff regularly, but it got to the point where I was starting to kind of tune everybody out. And I remember my boss, he turned to me one day as we were talking about something, and he's like, take off your headphones. Take them off. And he was kind of annoyed. And I was like, whoa. I kind of was caught off guard because he was a little bit irritated. But I thought about this moment. This was probably in 2013. And to this day, I think about that moment regularly. What he was calling me to do was to pay attention. I got to the point where I started to prefer podcasts to people. And I was starting to become deaf to the people in front of me and around me. I was disengaging. And so I was captivated by other voices, but the voices right in front of me, really the voice right in front of me, I wasn't listening. And what my boss is trying to tell me is like, hey, that's the voice that really matters. And it's something I've thought about regularly over the years. Sometimes we need confrontation, even if it's not handled the best. We just need it. Even sometimes when people are irritated or annoyed and they say things and they say, whoa. Biblically speaking, there's a way to confront. I'm not denying that. You take the log out of your eye. We do work on ourselves, all that stuff. But sometimes we do need people to help shake us up out of our slumber. And I was thinking about that this week. Take off your headphones. Who has your attention? Like, whose voice are you attuned to? Which voices do you want to listen to in life? Here's the second thing. If you're taking notes, write this down. You can't serve the crowd and the crown. You have to pick. The crowd itself, it can be a group of people, it can be a room, but sometimes it doesn't necessarily have to be a group of people in a room. It could be just an orientation at the heart that's completely horizontally focused. Here's what I mean by that. Sometimes the crowd that we listen to is the values of our culture that are reverberated back to us. They're actually more ingrained and deeply instilled in us than we know. When we find ourselves disengaging from the voice of God, we will be prioritizing somebody else's voice. We can't help ourselves. And so, who has your attention? Whose voice are you attuned to? What happened to Saul is that there was another voice that drowned out the voice of God. If we can throw quote number one up to the front, I found this to be helpful. It says, Saul valued the opinion of the people over God's wisdom. He feared people when he should have feared God. Moreover, he continued to worry about one thing in light of correction, his own reputation and honor. Saul is perpetually downplaying his role in the bad decisions he makes. He keeps bringing in other people as if they are responsible for his mistakes. Part of the reason why I want to focus in on this for just a minute is that it can be hard sometimes listening to talk like this to be like, okay, cool, what does this have to do with me? And one of the things that is important to recognize is that the way that you respond to confrontation can determine your path in life, can determine your direction. So Saul, when he was confronted by the prophet Samuel, what he defaulted to was blame shifting, minimizing, deflecting, and ultimately he resisted correction. Did you guys catch that? But I did obey the Lord. I did everything he said. And the reason I disobeyed was ... because I had a better idea. Saul was essentially saying, I know better. In some ways, you could say that Saul, under pressure, believed, I got this. I can handle this. I'll come up with a plan. Sometimes, like, the godliest person is just the person who sits and waits for God to come through. That was one of Saul's tragic flaws, was that he couldn't wait. I'm not suggesting that when we have a clear mandate from God that every time it's just going to be like, sit on the sidelines and wait. Sometimes we have to just, it's Monday morning, we got to go to work. So I'm not denying any of that. But what I am saying is that there are moments when God has spoken clearly about something, and our job is to simply trust that even if the circumstances look dire, he's going to come through. And that even if it costs you your life, he'll raise you on the other side from dishonor to honor. God doesn't make mistakes, and he doesn't break his promises. And Saul didn't believe it. He really struggled to believe. And so quote number two, let's throw this last quote up there. This is the cash. This is where I think the rubber meets the road. In Saul's story, we see a warning. It's crucial that we reflect on our own character flaws and how they harm us, as well as others. We can see how we need to humble ourselves and, with God's help, deal with our dark sides. Yes. You have a dark side. Did you know that? I do too, by the way. I'm becoming more. The last 4 years have been like a get to know the dark side since COVID. And it isn't to glorify it. It's not to build an identity around my darkness. It's actually to be able to step into the light. It's actually to be able to say, this isn't okay. This isn't what I was meant to be. And so the last 4 years of my life have really been this journey of experiencing God restoring me at the core of who I am. It's not just the last 4 years. It just feels like the last 4 years has been an intensification of it. I think God's been about this for a long, long, long time. But I just haven't been aware of how he's been doing this until really the last 4 years. The few years before that actually were getting to know the ways in which I needed renewal. I remember being in an office in San Diego talking to a mentor, and it was one of the hardest conversations of my life. And what ended up happening in that conversation was we had just a very honest talk about where I was at in that moment and where it was that I actually needed to pay attention. There were ways in which I was struggling that I needed somebody to just be like, here. And what he mentioned, what this mentor of mine mentioned, was that there's three areas of my life that really needed attention. And he listed them off with a lot of love and gentleness. And he said, this is what I see in you. And the biggest one that I'll never forget is he said that it's time to learn how to separate your identity from your performance. And those words cut to the core of me, as it were. Why? Because I was already in ministry, helping others to separate their identity from their performance. And so to hear that myself was like I have a dark side. I'm blind to the ways in which I am, what I'm really like, I don't actually see. But others see it. And so that conversation, I think, was a culmination of several years of following Jesus, where I think primarily what he was doing was just showing me the ways in which I needed to become like him. And then these last 4 years have been unpacking what that even means. Unpacking my own story, unpacking my own pain, unpacking my own sin and brokenness, seeing some of it come out in unfortunate ways, but then being able to go back and say, why? 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 That Back to the Future DeLorean, the one that fell into disrepair, there's a video clip, I'm not going to play it just for the sake of time, of the creator of Back to the Future. His name is Bob Gale. It's actually a couple of guys that created it, but he's one of the other guy went on to like do Forrest Gump, and I think he had a lot of other successes. I think Bob Gale is like, Back to the Future is like his baby. And so when Bob Gale found out about the state that the DeLorean was in, there's a video of him going like, no, 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 like this can't be. Like he said, I take this personally. And I just need you to understand, like, God takes the fall of his images personally. And he doesn't stand by idly. Idly. You guys know what I'm saying. He's not standing by and just being like, well, let's see what happens. Or you're on your own. Although sometimes it's like you get what you want. And it's scary when he gives us what we want. But the truth is, God is like standing, I think he's ready to receive anyone who's like broken about their brokenness. Saul's tragic flaw, here's the key, and I'm wrapping this up. Saul's tragic flaw is ours as well. Our hearts are fickle. We want glory and honor in front of the crowd or in front of the world, in front of people. But we forget that we were created for the glory and honor of the crown. You were created as an image of God to represent him to the world and, in a sense, to uniquely manifest him. God breathes his spirit into you. When you become a Christian, the spirit of God comes to live in you. And so, just like Adam and Eve, when Adam was created, it says that the wind of God, the breath of God filled humans. Now, when we become new humans, the Spirit of God fills us. And the Spirit of God is committed radically to restoring you. I don't know this for sure, but I'm pretty sure that's why we're called restored. Tom can confirm. Yep, confirmed. That's why we're called Restored Church. But I just want you guys to know that Saul's not random. Saul's a picture of humanity. Think about your own life. How often are you consumed with the horizontal? How often are you consumed with the cultural values, the things that with power and approval, control? These aren't biblical values. Not that power is bad. Not that approval is bad. Not even that having a sense of control over our lives is all bad. But I'm saying when that's what we live for, it leads to disaster and calamity. Or comfort. Hey, Southern California, I don't know if you know this, we like to chill. Not as much as San Diego chill, but Temecula is still chill. San Diego, there's a deeper chill. There's like a, you know? Doesn't really make sense what I'm saying, but I think you know. If you lived in San Diego, you know. It's like chill, like to the like level 9 chill. Temecula is like 7. It's like suburban chill. It's a different kind of chill because you have children and you can't chill as much. Now chill is Bluey's on in the background and you're napping. Or you're watching and you're like, this is the best thing I've ever seen. But that's what chill is. In San Diego, you don't have kids typically. Well, that's not true. There's children in San Diego, 6 or 7 of them. And there's somebody else's kids. You're just chilling. We're going to pause in that there. But my point is, there's all these different things that we can live for, but they're actually false hopes. They're false hopes. And God loves you too much to allow you to live for things that will fail you and ultimately lead to your disrepair at the soul level. God's on about something. And I think this message was born in the prayer room. I was in the prayer room, and I just kind of sensed God saying, like, Saul, guard your heart. And I was like, excuse me? And then I started thinking, like, oh, there's some Sauls in the Bible. Which one? Oh, yeah. Oh. That's what happened. Saul didn't guard his heart. Saul, if Saul was a vehicle, he was a vehicle that you never, like, he never went in for regular maintenance. He didn't get his oil changed. What happens when that happens, Jonathan? When you don't do your maintenance? Explosions. Explosions, guys. No, cars come with a maintenance schedule. Jonathan, confirm this, can you? Yep. Cars come with a maintenance schedule, and there's these different things that happen. There's these little breakdowns that happen over time if you don't take care of it. And I think what God was reminding me of in the prayer room, I think maybe part of what he wants to remind us of today, is that there's a certain level of soul maintenance that needs to take place in order for us not to break down and crash. And a lot of it is at the core of why we exist as a church. It's to be able to ask the question, why? When something in your life is not lining up with the truth of God, those that can ask the why question and sit with the answer are very likely to experience God and change. But those who minimize and deflect, like Saul did, are very likely to get stuck. And there is no stuck, really. You just start to reverse. And that leads to disrepair and to decay. But the good news is, God is so committed to you. God's like Bob Gale, and he's like, no, no, no. Something has to be done about the DeLorean. But something has to be done about us, with the human condition. And here's what God did. He sent the image, Jesus. He sent Jesus, his son, to become the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. That's Colossians 1:15. If you guys don't mind throwing that up so that we can see this. So while Adam and Eve fell, Saul fell, even David. David was on the rise. I can't get into it. But as Saul was declining and into disrepair, he was falling apart. David was rising. Did you guys know that David eventually fell too? Why I'm 7 feet tall right now, I'm not sure. Maybe just to get your attention. Like, David fell too. And all humanity, we're prone to this, where our hearts are fickle. But here's what God did. He sent a true image, Jesus, to become the firstborn over all creation. In the places that we have fallen and failed, in the places where we've actually listened to the crowd, in the places where we have adopted the values of the culture, in the places where we've lived for false idols, Jesus never did that. In fact, one of my favorite visuals of Jesus is like he's, do you guys remember when he was around a crowd towards the end of his life? And people were telling him, like, why don't you come off that cross, Jesus? The crowd was mocking him and taunting him and telling him, like, hey, if you are the Son of God, as it were, come down off that cross. But Jesus was secure in his identity. He didn't put his hope in the crowd, but in the crown. And he was willing to suffer much in this life. And you know what God did? He vindicated him by raising him from the dead. And that's the promise that every Christian has now. The promise is that we are now becoming like Jesus. We do suffer and we do sin, so I'm not denying any of that. We go through hard things. People do things to us. We do things to us. Sometimes we're wounded because of our own sin. Did you know that that's possible? To sin and be wounded? Sometimes it's possible for others to sin and wound us. But sometimes our own sin has this tragic consequence. And it hurts us. But God is committed to this. Colossians 3, verses 9 to 10. He talks about the transformation that he's doing. Don't lie to one another since you have put off, here's the key, you've put off the old self with its practices and you have put on the new self. You're being renewed in knowledge according to the image of your creator. God is completely committed to architecting your restoration. So I want to ask you a couple questions. What are you facing today? Is there heat that you're under, pressure that you're facing? What's wearing you out? Think of the picture of that DeLorean out in the sun. Did you know just exposure to life can do a number on you? What's wearing you out in life today? Where are you being tempted in your life? One of the things that blew my mind was that in that DeLorean, they didn't say it in the video that I showed you, but there were rats living in it. They're like rat nests in. Rat's nest? Can somebody confirm this?
Yes.
Confirmed. Rat's nest. And I heard this once. I'm mixing two things here. But if you take the picture of like an icon, as it were, that needs to be restored. You're an image of God that needs restoration. Sometimes when we don't tend to our hearts, when we don't guard our hearts, and we experience wounding, Satan can make a nest in your wounds. I heard that from Terry Wardle, influential Christian leader. Are there wounds that Satan is nesting in your life? Are there wounds that maybe need attention that haven't experienced healing yet? And when somebody presses on it, all hell breaks loose in your life. I think God wants to do a deep work. I have this DeLorean that Josh and I built. It's like a little small one, like a toy. And my daughter, Ellie, got a hold of it, and she took the mirrors off, the side mirrors. So it's like a DeLorean with no mirrors, which is great. Those mirrors are gone, never to be found again. No idea where they are. But as I was thinking about this message, I was chewing on this, I just felt like the picture, the memory of that, those mirrors being gone came back, and I was like, okay, what might this mean? And it struck me, if you don't have side mirrors, what do you not see? Your blind spots. Man, like, do you know where your blind spots are? Where are your blind spots? I think God may want to restore the knowledge of your blind spots this morning to some of you, as he's been restoring the knowledge of my blind spots to me over these last several years. Man, when you're confronted, here's the key. What's your response when you're confronted? I'll just keep this really, really brief. I recently apologized to someone because I realized that years ago they had confronted me about some things and that I responded with like resistance. I got prickly. I got irritated and I turned it around on them. And so I went back and I apologized recently after reading this because I realized, I did the Saul thing because there was truth to what they were saying. And that actually, all it did was stunt my growth, stunt my development. And I recognized as I was reading these verses, like Saul minimized, he deflected, he shifted blame, and he resisted correction. David also fell. If you don't know that story, I can't get into all of it right now. But David fell. He sinned really hard in a spectacular way that's still talked about to this day. But Saul failed, and what we have are the stories, kind of what I told you today. And he, in his life, at the end of his life, he falls on a sword and dies. He dies this grisly death. It's horrible. It's tragic. It's really sad. David fell, and he gave us a good chunk of the Psalter. David gave us Psalm 51. If you've never read Psalm 51, when you blow it, that's where you turn. I remember once just blowing it so hard, and I just felt so much conviction. I lost my temper. I got angry. I said things I shouldn't have. Do you know where I turned? Psalm 51. Psalm 51 talks about what it looks like to turn your heartbreak, as it were, into healing and into praise. David humbled himself in response to confrontation. When the prophet came to David and called him out for his sin, he turned. Man, when you're confronted, what is your response? Do you know that there's generational impact for those who respond with humility to confrontation? There can be. David gave us Psalm 51. Saul fell on a sword. Man, what do you want? I'm going to call the band up to the front. I'm going to invite you to stand if you're able. And I just want to ask you the question, what do you want? What does your heart like desire the most? When you're confronted, when you become aware of things, when you recognize your own flaws and faults, what do you want? Do you want to save face or do you want to stay free? I want to close with some words out of 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18. This is the Apostle Paul, and he wrote, "We all, with unveiled faces, are looking as in a mirror at the glory of the Lord and are being transformed into the image, the same image, from glory to glory. This is from the Lord who is the Spirit." That's the heart of God. He wants to transform you. But it will only happen as we get a hold of Jesus. And we'll only get a hold of Jesus when we realize, I need him. I'm sinful and broken. There's many other messages that can be preached on this topic. What do you do when criticism feels unfair? That's another conversation for another day. Today I'm just talking about when you have genuinely biblically blown it. When there is pride, when there are other competing interests at a heart level that are governing you, that are ruling you, and somebody brings it to your attention, God wants to transform that as you look to Jesus, who forgives people who don't deserve it, who blesses people who blow it, and who is committed to transforming people whose lives have maybe even fallen into disrepair, or whose hearts have been needing attention for a while and maybe haven't gotten it. So I'm going to pray. And I'm just going to ask you the question, like, what does this look like for you? What transformation do you need? What is God saying to you? Father, we thank you that your heart for people is to see the image of God restored in us, so that we might together glorify you, so that we might together, as it were, like manifest what you're like in the world, represent you, and bring hope and healing to the nations. Because when they experience us, they're getting a preview of what's to come. They're getting to experience Jesus. Not that we are Jesus, but that we are his hands and feet. God, I want to be that kind of person more and more, and I'm confident that my brothers and sisters in this room want to increasingly grow to become like Jesus and to represent him well, to image him into our homes, our workplaces, our neighborhoods, the coffee shop, wherever we're at. God, would you help us to see where we need you? Where are we tempted to follow the crowd and listen to it and not the crown? God, are there failures that we need forgiveness for? Are there trials where we really are struggling right now and we need to be strengthened in the midst of them so that we won't falter? Are there people in our lives that need encouragement in the midst of their trial? Or maybe they've fallen and they need to be gently restored. And I thank you that you are committed to architecting our restoration, and that your heart is no, no, no. I must save humanity. I will not let this fallen image remain fallen forever. Thank you, Father. Would you do a work in us, a deep work in us this morning, in the time that we have left? Would you give us each something to walk away with from you to take home? God, we love you and we bless you. In your name we pray. Amen. Okay, I'm going to call the prayer team up to the front. And I'm going to call Tom as well so that he can set up a response.